Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It's The Wonky Show. Today we're talking about franchise higher education. We preview Labour's Securenomics agenda and what it might look like in government for universities and ask why sexual harassment is back in the news. It's all coming up.
But is that why franchising is expanding, or is it the financial sustainability element of this? And I think if it is the latter, the sector needs to take a really long, hard look at this.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to dip a toe into the week of higher education are three fantastic guests as always. In Southwest London, it's Julian Gravatt, Deputy Chief Exec at the Association of Colleges. Julian, your higher of the week, please.
I was at Gresham College this week, which is my favourite place, the 11th lecture in a series of 18 about the science of climate change. Gresham College, brilliant institution. It's fantastic in person, but you can see all the lectures online. It's a kind of long-form lecture, like the vinyl record is always going to be with us.
Lovely. And in Water Beach, it's Sally Burtonshaw, Associate Director for Education at Public First. Sally, your hire for the week, please.
Hi, Mark. I think my highlight was talking to the Martingale Foundation, who support STEM graduates onto postgraduate qualifications, so both masters and PhDs. They're doing some fantastic, really, really interesting work in a space supporting underrepresented students to kind of build that pipeline, which is fantastic to hear about.
Very nice. And in Oxford, it's Michael Salmon, Wonky's news editor. Michael, your hire of the week, please.
Hi, Mark. Yeah, it's been a really good week in the world of competitive chess. I've really enjoyed the climax of the 2024 candidates tournament. I won't say the result in case any of our listeners are planning on catching up, but it was, yeah, fantastic finale on Monday.
Right. We start the week with a new report out from the Public Accounts Committee on Franchise Higher Education. Michael, please walk us through the whole thing.
Yeah. So franchising is back in the news yet again. So this is, when universities are subcontracting out their courses to, to colleges, or in the case of what the committee's looking at here, really into sort of independent private providers, often quite new, often quite small, often a little opaque, what exactly is being delivered. And as you said, yeah, the Public Accounts Committee in the House of Commons had an inquiry, they had a hearing back in February, and they've published their report. It's very interesting, lots to look at. They've sort of made recommendations on how DfE, how the Department of Education, Student Loans Company and Office for Students should be working together more and sort of more effectively to look at these issues around student loan fraud and students sort of not actually being attending courses they were paid for through the student finance system. We've had all this before from the National Audit Office's report, which sort of was the impetus for the inquiry. But I think what's really interesting and what sort of moves the conversation forward here with the committee is that they've made sort of other recommendations around regulation and transparency that now DfE and OFS are going to have to respond to. So it's things like, something that really caught the committee's attention, which is not really about fraud at all, but that, they really latched onto this point about universities, so the ones who are franchising out, retaining large shares in some cases of tuition fees, up to 30%, that was their sort of their cut of the income, and they've said these should be published, the split should be published, there should be a breakdown, where's this money going. They've asked the Office for Students to publish much clearer student outcomes data so we can really see the difference in outcomes around students at franchises and students at the main university, and they've asked DfE to at least consider requiring all franchising operations to be registered with the Office for Students. This was, again, something that really caught their attention, the fact that the majority, you know, a large number of these colleges giving courses are not registered with the Office for Students, and we don't really have a good idea what is going on there. So yeah, there's some interesting recommendations here that sort of move it from just being about fraud to being a sort of wider question about, you know, what do we know and what should we know about franchising?
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll come back to his recommendations. Julian, no one should be very surprised, should they? Because this all sounds quite familiar.
I've been dealing with reports on franchising for longer than I can remember, really, and it's always been a big issue in further education, but it's also always been a big issue in higher education. I think, some universities started out on a franchise basis, but I guess we're in a world now where there's large amounts of money, and we've got finance-driven providers, and we've got consumers, students who sometimes don't have all the information that they kind of need. And in a sense, you have to spend a lot of time thinking about how to design this market to make sure you get the right outcomes. And so the Public Accounts Committee are back again on this subject about 6 or 7 years after they last had a big push on it. And it's a decent report. I mean, it's got some sensible recommendations. I think I agree with the piece on your site from David Kernahan about whether it goes far enough in terms of what's needed to done to tackle some of the issues in here.
Sally, from a kind of university point of view, this is still quite far upstream, isn't it, from actual new rules coming into place and things that need to be done. But surely there's quite a lot that you need to be looking at in terms of your franchise position, because if OFS and SLC and DfE do start tightening up as per the recommendations, then there is going to be a whole bunch of new stuff to respond to, isn't there?
Yeah, I think this feels simultaneously not shocking, but also a potentially really significant problem for the sector, because it is just a national scandal waiting to happen. And I think that there's sort of two things that make it particularly acute. I think firstly, there is the scale. So this kind of doubling in franchise provision since 2018, which then just like lends itself, it is just a bigger news story and a bigger issue than it was 5 years ago. And I think also the percentage of fraud was, you know, is a relatively significant amount, 2.2 million. It is starting to grow as an issue. And I think whether or not we tackle it as a sector, we know that this is optically very, very bad if this hits headlines. And I think, you know, the sort of the universities creaming off up to 30% lands really badly. The optics with the public are really poor. And I think if we are, as a sector, going to get ahead of this, we absolutely should. We don't necessarily always need to wait for regulation. We do need to think much more carefully about what is the right thing to do and make sure that franchising, which I think has a really important place and there are lots of benefits that are often discussed, doesn't end up being something that the sector is sort of lambasted for.
Yeah, and Michael, there's a lot of stuff, isn't there, that is going on that isn't really about fraud, but is kind of not really using the loan system and the regulatory system in the way that it was designed for, because you've got this kind of transfer of student loan cash to a bunch of providers who aren't registered and so aren't really properly regulated. And all of that, you know, there might be some fraud there, but it's all completely above board because the system's kind of allows for it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think there's this sort of, you know, question hanging over a lot of the commentary on it, and a lot of kind of what sort of springs to mind with the MPs on this committee who are not higher education experts. But there's this question of just, you know, is this how we want the system to be? You know, not just the question of, you know, is there fraud happening sort of on the margins of, and we this is sort of how we wanted it, and we just stamp out the fraud and have better controls in place, and then things are okay again. But, you know, is this in terms of size and shape and you know, subject and geography, you know, is this where we want the system to be expanding? Because...
Yeah, Michael, that's such a good point. I think that the often we end up with these like sort of two binaries where it's sort of the idea of franchising. So the benefits of partnership working, you get HE in areas that don't have a university, you get smaller providers who wouldn't be able to sustain that infrastructure ordinarily, you have that widening participation pipeline, and all of that is really positive. But is that why franchising is expanding, or is it the financial sustainability element of this? And I think if it is the latter, the sector needs to take a really long, hard look at this. And if it is the former, then that's brilliant. And we need to be supporting it and making sure that the optics of this do kind of stay true to the true mission of franchising.
Yeah, people say sort of very sensible things about, you know, the benefits of universities, say, for example, validating, you know, work in FE colleges or, you know, providers that began having as a sort of franchise, you know, and, you know, all these things you've just said about cold spots and certain courses that can happen because otherwise they wouldn't, you know. But it doesn't, you know, if we look back to the New York Times investigation and our own Jim Dickinson's investigations last summer, you know, the kind of stuff we're talking about here and the kind of stuff where it appears that fraud is happening is not that, right? And so I think there's a sort of often talking at cross purposes thing where, you know, there's people who really understand the benefits of validation and articulation agreements and all this kind of thing who, you know, are concerned that regulatory action is going to stamp down or make life very difficult for the kind of good work they're doing. And then there's these sort of other people who, are, you know, these voices are not really participating in the debate. They're too busy sort of, you know, putting the big checks into the bank and, you know, paying out massive dividends to themselves. So it's, you know, it's tricky to talk about franchising and validation and articulation like they're one thing, you know. I think, but that's why for me it comes back to this question of, you know, is this sort of explosion, especially in sort of business courses, they're, you know, massively in London, you know, which has many, many universities, you know, as you know, Sally, you know, is that really what we want the expansion of our HE system to look like? Or, you know, are there other ways of doing it? Because how the student loan system works and the behaviors that it enables is a form of the government, you know, planning HE, even if they don't want to think that they're planning HE and they're sort of letting it happen and, you know, leaving it up to choice and things, you know, it is still a form of directing where our sector's going.
Just to follow up that point, Michael, I mean, it's I think it's worth unpicking some of the details in terms of those franchised providers, because of those 200 providers who aren't on the register, I mean, 20 of them are FE colleges who are effectively too small to go through the registration process and so have a long-standing partnership. UUK put a very good bit of evidence into the Public Accounts Committee, which pointed out also that NHS trusts are also, in some cases, unregistered providers working with a registered provider. So, in a, and it's recommended that in terms of the recommendation about getting people onto the register, that should be focused on those who aren't registered entirely. And I mean, to follow up Sally's point, there are whenever I see evidence of a partnership in post, yeah, I come across, you know, sort of an advert or something, I often look at the accounts of the university that is claimed as being the partner, and I'm surprised sometimes at how little people disclose about what look to me to be quite big franchise arrangements. And so there's a little bit of sort of self-regulation and explanation that people could do about what the rationale is for the arrangements that they've got in place. And some of the ones that come into London from distance do seem pretty puzzling, I have to say.
I think the other thing that strikes me in terms of the clarity is that often the students or potential students that are being targeted to join these courses are those who are perhaps least able to navigate the systems. So we, you know, we've talked about franchising in cold spots, building the pipeline. But those students are unlikely to have people around them who are maybe doing sort of the due diligence that a middle-class parent of an 18-year-old may be thinking about, and may not have kind of the ability to navigate that system. So I think there's a question about not just how we articulate it, but how we articulate this, not to ourselves, not to within the sector and justify it within the sector, but really kind of look those people in the eye and say, this is the best possible provision for you, and we can stand by that. And I think that at the moment, some of the solutions that we're talking about are still quite internal rather than really conveying that clear message to the public. And if we're uncomfortable about conveying that, then maybe we shouldn't be doing it at all.
Yeah, I think this is something Jim's written about, isn't it, based on conversations he's had with you, that you know, the regulation of franchising that FE colleges do sort of out to partners is much more heavily regulated. You know, again, it's this conversation about sort of, you know, burden and stifling good work that's going on, you know, one size fits all. Is it, you know, but should there be more regulation of franchising? I mean, it feels like the way it's going, you know, both on the fraud size, on the scale size, and just the sort of, you know, lack of understanding exactly what it is, that, you know, there inevitably will be some kind of move from DfE. They've already said as part of their HE reform consultation response that it is something they're kind of very slowly doing. But yeah, I think going back to what Sally said earlier about, you know, students and students' voices not really being in this conversation, which is sort of inevitable because it is a, it's been quite a sort of, accountancy driven investigation around the student loan system and things. But it is really important, you know, to be thinking about students. And the other thing I'm always wondering about is about staff as well, you know, because when you're seeing, okay, universities taking a cut, which in some cases is up to 30%, the providers, the franchisees making enormous profits. I mean, how much money and in what conditions are the staff who are teaching on these courses working in? You know, what's their background? You know, how much sort of, how does that differ to higher education as we think it is in terms of, you know, the sort of qualified staff and, you know, sort of connections to research and experience as part of an academic community? You know, that side of the question, I think, needs further unpicking too.
There's also some students will have quite a transactional view on this. They will literally want to get themselves a qualification. And if it's a respected institution's qualification, then they'll be, maybe they won't mind if it's pretty low engagement transaction. I guess then the issue, which is then, is it has the institution that's franchising at some distance really thought through what it's doing to its own reputation by involving in this relationship?
Yeah, no, that is completely true. And I mean, we've seen in terms of how some of these courses are marketed that it is very much sort of, you know, get a degree, get a maintenance payment as well. You know, there is then the question of whether students realize they're putting themselves on the hook for 40 years of student loan repayments, but you're right. I mean, it is in some sense driven by an appetite for students to, you know, quickly get hold of, quickly or sort of, you know, flexibly and in from, by the sounds of it, with sort of less effort and less attendance than they might need in other places to get qualifications, but also to get access to student finance and maintenance, which is the other side of the problem.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Paul Clark and I'm currently working as a strategy consultant. Until recently, I was the Vice President for Strategy at UCL, and prior to that, I was the Chief Executive of HESA. I recently authored an article on the importance of data stewardship for leveraging the benefits of AI in universities, and want to recount the key points here. Every day, we hear more and more about the potential positive impacts of AI on higher education, and excitement levels are rightly high. However, unless universities ensure the foundations of good data governance are in place, these positive benefits will not materialise. Managing this requires the effective coordination of disparate activities within the university, including software development, technology infrastructure, data protection and security, and data management. More importantly, it requires putting the people and the culture first. I suggest three steps that universities can take to improve their data governance. First, make data governance a priority at the senior leadership level. Second, build a cross-functional group to lead data governance work, comprising all the many viewpoints and perspectives required. Third, prioritise initial areas of focus according to business need in order to make rapid progress and avoid getting bogged down. The institutions that adopt these measures will put themselves in the best place to take advantage of the coming benefits of AI.
Now, there's been a couple of interesting new reports fleshing out some thinking about how Labour might act in government. Sally, walk us through it.
Yeah, so this is in the context of sort of no massive new policy announcements from Labour in the HE or education space. Although for those of us who commute via train, I think this morning was quite an exciting morning. But we know that kind of Labour's funding envelope is very tight. We know that Labour are being very cautious about what they are announcing in terms of their financing their plans and also legislating. But we've got these two reports out, one from the Social Market Foundation on Labour's economic agenda and one on reform, on sort of how to deliver mission-led government that I think are sort of really interesting and worth thinking about in the context of what this means for higher education. So probably take the reform one first, which is a very laudable, I think, a how-to guide to deliver mission-led government. So we often hear about the five missions at the moment from Labour. There is often a lack of clarity and detail about what being a mission-led government actually will mean in practice. And what reform have done here is really try to say, well, this is what it could look like. So, you know, the benefits of a mission-led government is this idea of a really clear purpose. there's often sort of analogies with putting a man on the moon, coming together around a sort of national agenda. And Labour are trying to do this with their five missions. So there's that kind of ambition, national renewal and growth. The missions are all cross-cutting, which in some ways is really exciting, and in some ways is a practical and logistical nightmare if you think about how you would actually implement it. And so Reform have really tried to sort of think through who is going to deliver this, how are they going to deliver it, how does that work with the civil service, how does that work with individual secretaries of state, who leads them, and what's that, and what's the accountability look like? And then the Social Market Foundation have released a report looking at Labour's economic agenda more broadly. And there are three chapters on innovation, universities and the skills system that I think are particularly interesting. On the first one, the innovation chapter, this is really sort of thinking about sort of how Labour are going to approach innovation. They have made sort of the suggestions that some of which sort of feel fairly obvious, but maybe need stating about the need to play to our strengths, the need to set a strategy to increase funding and to address the regional imbalance in innovation, all of which I think universities have a really strong part to play. So we know that there are examples of universities who are already kind of playing to their strengths in terms of their locality. I think a really good example of this is probably Exeter. I've lost my train of thought. A really good example of this is Exeter on sort of the massive presence they have in Cornwall and mining, because this is where the UK's major supply of lithium is. We need kind of to lean into more examples of kind of institutions who are playing to their local and regional strengths. And the idea of sort of this regional imbalance moving away from the Golden Triangle. So you've got sort of the Golden Triangle and then a massive gap before Manchester and Leeds, which is apparently the sort of the next powerhouse institutional regional join up. So innovation was one. The next one was sort of very specifically focused on HE. Again, kind of the same messages. So backing clusters of higher education institutions. Working regionally with other bodies, so combined authorities, working to deliver on skills, thinking about kind of how we support the research pipeline regionally as well as globally and nationally. So I think that there was a huge amount in there that was of interest to universities, but I think it probably all comes back to this notion that education and higher education is not high up on Labour's agenda. And so universities really, really need to be asking sort of what they can do for this national mission and how they can feed into the five missions and how they can sort of play a part in that conversation, particularly around kind of innovation and growth. That is our kind of ticket into the conversation. And we should be thinking really hard about that. And these two reports sort of think about that in a bit more detail.
Right. So Julian, I mean, universities may not be top of the agenda, but a lot of this would be quite encouraging, wouldn't it? I think universities would rather an approach based on securenomics than sort of what we've got under the current government. I don't know even how you would describe it, but sort of kept in the freezer and allowed to decline, and occasionally throwing rocks at.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be an interesting and challenging few years, isn't it? I mean, there's a big appetite for change, and the papers have set out some of these two reports set out how this could happen, but the fiscal constraint is so tight that I think it's also going to be a real challenge for anybody in what I describe as post 16 education, is the fact that we've got more young adults at just the point when the money's really tight. And so I don't quite know how some of those things are going to get resolved. One thing that also really comes out in the papers is that if you look across the Social Market Foundation thing, is that what they say that is really needed to get the growth back that we need is more business investment, and business investment's only going to come if people feel confident about long term policy, if there's a bit of security, because we've had four prime ministers in the last few years has meant that we've had lots and lots of change. But whereas when you have if a government wins a majority and gets a 5-year term, then perhaps we can get some of that security, and perhaps then that can get some confidence back.
I think this very much sort of speaks to the role of universities and how we sort of see universities in Securenomics. So this sort of more active role of the state and the strategic state working with business and with providers, I think kind of speaks to the security that lots of institutions will crave after this period of massive instability. But I think it's also worth thinking about Labour's missions as 10-year missions rather than 1 5-year term. And that's not necessarily Labour sort of being complacent, but I think it is about saying a lot of these things are going to take more than 5 years. So when we talk about universities and the role they can play and also the problems that they have, I think it's really important that we as a sector are aware enough not to just continue to go to government with a begging bowl, but to ask the questions about how we can support government missions and therefore how kind of universities can therefore be financed in order to increase that support rather than the sort of, you know, raise fees for universities, which is becoming a bit of a tired message, I think, in some spaces. And I think we need to be really careful about how we position ourselves as a sector.
Totally agree, but also it's about getting a positive message about what it is that higher education can do to deal with some of these big societal and economic challenges. But and it's really difficult. It's going to be really difficult to do that at the same time as there's a small but growing number of institutions who are in financial difficulty and are making cutbacks. And so you have to kind of separate the kind of long term positivity and what the sectors can do to contribute to what needs to be done versus what sensible resolution mechanisms there can be to stop kind of instability. So.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that that university failure is going to be high on the agenda, both for the sector, but also for Labour. I think it is worth sort of thinking a bit ideologically about the differences between the current government and a Labour government. You know, the Tory model is predicated on the idea of a free market, and therefore there is going to be market exit. That is inherent in the sort of ideology. That's not where Labour's thinking is. And I think, you know, that will change how they approach university failure. So whether that will look like a, I don't know, like a bailout, more sort of state involvement. Labour are going to be very reluctant to let a university, particularly in a, you know, in an area where there isn't large amounts of other provision, they're going to be reluctant to let that fail. But I think that's something that we should be really thinking about as a sector, because there is going to be, it's not going to be an overnight solution to have a Labour government and get more funds into the sector. So I think we all need to be thinking carefully about that. The other thing that I think is really important is conceptualising universities as civic anchors. A lot of Labour's rhetoric is about devolution. It is about place-based. It is not about social mobility. It is about social justice, but it is about whole areas and you know, lifting up whole areas. And universities have a really strong role to play in that. In lots of areas, you know, take Sunderland, like they are the key civic anchor. There are lots of them. And I think we need to be really thinking about how universities can sort of supercharge some of those areas and what role they have to play, both in terms of R&D, but also in terms of their sort of wider role in civic society, which I think is really exciting. It's something that Labour want to talk about, and we should be doing it more.
And then just to follow it on from that, I mean, quite a surprising thing in the Social Market Foundation articles was Alison Wolfe was quite pro-devolution, though. And so perhaps some of that work that universities do in place could be secured by, I don't know, going down where the route that we've got an adult skills, that you've got a closer relationship, funding relationship between combined authorities and mayors and higher education. I mean, it's something that I know that would cause much concern in universities, but colleges have been running with this for 5 years and are watching the forthcoming mayor elections with great interest.
Yeah, completely. There's a sort of, you know, there's a level of enthusiasm in the sector, and especially in the sort of, you know, the think tanky kind of community about, you know, could higher education and science and the sort of skill system get on board with these ideas of missions and place based and Securenomics and all things. But, you know, reading the Onward, the Reform pamphlets, forget getting my think tanks mixed up, you know, it's quite clear that, you know, getting a sort of mission driven government is going to sort of have quite a lot of, is going to demand quite a lot of control and influence on what its sort of component parts do. I mean, you know, if you look at what they're saying about science and R&D there, they are, you know, they're suggesting that this should be much more sort of, you know, divided up and sort of strategically used by governments, you know, what this would mean for sort of, you know, discovery research and, you know, based sort of attempting to further the discipline and just sort of, you know, the mission of UKRI more generally. If you were thinking about, okay, chopping research up into sort of health mission, you know, defense, as we've seen with Sunak, you know, and we see it all over the world in the EU and other countries that increasingly research and innovation funding is quite tightly controlled and directed by governments. And, you know, while there's nothing really there, you know, crystallized about education, you could sort of see that, you know, universities might sort of feel excited to get involved with it, but it also may result in them needing to take more direction to sort of, you know, be working and being driven by sort of local governments, as Julian said, and all these things. And it could be quite a shift to the sort of business as usual we've had over the last, you know, since number controls came off and it became this sort of, you know, quasi-market system. It could look quite different. And there's this overarching question about, you know, okay, does this all just mean universities are part of the public sector now?
I think for me, we always have to go back to the fact that when we poll the public, at Public First, they say, you know, we've got fewer than 1 in 12 people who see education as one of the most important issues. Higher education is a subsection of that. And we know from our recent polling work that the changes to fees are kind of not a vote winner or a vote loser. So we know that kind of the issues that the higher education sector are kind of acutely concerned by right now are an issue for Labour. Like, I think they're not kind of unaware of the strain on finances in HE. But they also know that it's not going to win or lose in the election. And they don't have the financial headroom to start funding the sector in the way that perhaps we would want. So getting involved in these conversations is our ticket to getting involved, you know, getting the HE sector involved in government and relevant to government and to the public. And I think over the last few years, it often strikes me that we talk more and more to ourselves and we think less and less about how we can serve communities and serve the public in that sort of civic agenda that lots of our kind of great red brick universities started from. I think this is probably a reminder to the sector to kind of circle back to that. That is the way that we speak to government, and we play a really important role in this mission-driven government.
Yeah, I think one other thing that is interesting reading these think tank reports, as I do on a daily basis, is it does feel like there's quite a lot of sort of, you know, policy entrepreneurship with trying to get Labour's attention around the science and R&D side of universities. And around the education side, you know, I just am not seeing think tanks putting out interesting, big, ambitious proposals for the education side of HE. You know, there's plenty of arguments about sort of, you know, changes to the levy, the apprenticeships levy and things like that. But, you know, in terms of really the business of educating students to sort of undergraduate and postgraduate level, you know, it's just notable there's not this time round, at least not yet, there don't seem to be sort of big ambitious ideas in think tank land for you know, how Labour should be getting to grips with this. Perhaps because, as you said, Sally, they just, you know, people just don't see a high possibility that there's going to be a big investment or a big appetite for change in the early years, at least.
I guess think about Michael. I mean, there's partly the problem is that people are aware of the fiscal constraints of sort of scrubbing around with quite a complicated system. But I mean, looking a bit widely, there's quite a lot of work going on about, you know, how AI is potentially going to change or not change education. So there's quite a lot of thinking about how education might be changing. I mean, though some of that is hype.
I think also Alison Wolfe makes a really interesting point in the Social Market Foundation essay that she has written about the fact that a lot of these sort of education investment questions are a 30-year question. And so at the moment when Labour are more in election mentality, I think it is laudable to have these missions, but the reality of sort of policy making right now is pivoting much more towards that retail offer. And so I think that we're probably not in the right time right now to be landing kind of those sorts of asks of Labour. I think it will be really interesting to see if and when Labour form a government as to what they want to do around sort of progression to higher education. Obviously, if you go back to 97, we've got that's such a clear mandate, education, 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 whether it translated into action or not, I think it's up for debate. But on a sort of more sort of personal level, I guess, we should be really aware that you know, Bridget Phillipson, as the shadow education secretary, has a very personal story of social mobility and progression through HE being her ticket into her kind of career. And I think if you look at the sort of speeches she has given, there is often sort of a more personal element that describes her journey. And also as a constituency MP, she has consistently asked the question about, well, if the national average is 50% progression rates at 18, why is in Sunderland and her constituency, it's sort of half that? So I think that there is an interest from Labour in that sort of more personal capacity, as well as a strategic one around who is going and how they benefit, that we should all sort of be thinking about.
The Festival of Higher Education is back for its second year. This November, Wonky and the University of London will welcome you to Senate House for two amazing days of one-to-one conversations with HE leaders, set piece debates and insights from journalists, policymakers and experts. You'll hear from speakers inside and outside the sector, take part in amazing interactive sessions, learn about new research, data and ideas, and meet colleagues, old and new, all equipping you with fresh thinking and insights ready to take back and share with your universities and teams. It's going to be an unmissable event for anyone with an interest in the future of UK higher education in what will be a critical year for the sector. That's 12th and 13th November in London. Early bird tickets are available for a short time only, so do hurry if you want to take advantage of these. We sold out really quickly last year, but once they're gone, they're gone. Find out more and book your tickets at thefestivalofhe.com or follow the links from wonky.com. We can't wait to see you in November.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi, Mark. So as you know, I'm in the Balkans and Austria this week with a group of student unions on a study tour. And as you also know, one of the things that's happened this week is that HEPI has published a report on student dropout, fresh thinking on student dropout. And as luck would have it, or rather as bad luck would have it, depending on how you look at it, here in Graz in Austria on day two of our tour, where we've arrived this afternoon, we've arrived in a country which, according to the OECD figures, has a really poor score on dropout, really high levels of dropout. However, the dropout rate significantly reduces here in Austria when students have longer to complete. So earlier tonight, I was in a beer hall with a couple of folk engaged in the Austrian student movement. And I started by asking them what their reaction would be if, as is kind of common in the UK, a new higher education regulator was to pop up in Austria and demand that a much, much higher percentage of students were required to complete their course within the theoretical degree length.
How the fuck do they want to do that? Because the infrastructure isn't, like, first, the infrastructure isn't there to do that. Like, so many students would fail, universities would lose so much money, because it's just not possible. And also, it shouldn't be possible, because students should take the time that they need to finish it. Students should be able to take a break, to do voluntary work, and to just freely choose what they want to do with their time.
Not everyone has the time or money to make studying a full-time thing.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of, even in Austria, where it doesn't cost as much as in the UK, a lot of people can't afford to just study and do nothing else. I think the average of how much people work is about 20 hours a week for students. So to expect them to do the full course load in six semesters is insane. It's crazy.
The government would need to pay us to study for that to work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. If you do that, fine. But yeah, you're charging people in the UK $9,000 a semester. It's very something different. Yeah, and the whole point of studying is to give students the knowledge they need, and in many cases want to, be smarter people, to be more competent people, so they can go into the workforce. If you rush them, then they're just going to. In German, you say learn bulimically. They're going to learn it straight off the exam and never know it ever again.
Okay, but look, so without going into the detail of what it is when you're a student, what you get when you're a student, we can, you know, how many credits, ECTS credits, do you have to be studying in a semester? How many do you have to sign up for to maintain student status?
But even just to remain a student in Austria, I think you just need to show that you're being active and taking exams. Yes.
Right.
I don't even think there's a limit, is there?
No, it isn't actually. It comes down to what your own experience is. So, for example, if you have depression and you can't take exams, it's okay as long as you prove that you couldn't do the exams.
Yeah. So let me get this right. So let's imagine I'm a bachelor's student, I get to my second year, I'm having a period of depression.
Yes.
I can just stop for a little while.
Yes.
Still have a student house, still use student discounts, whatever.
Yes, yes.
And then pick it back up when I'm ready.
Yes.
Yeah. This is mind-blowing in the UK.
Well, I think people might call that healthy, to be able to take a break when you're going through depression. I mean, this world can be very depressing, especially for young people.
Yeah.
And to have a system that accommodates that is very nice.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take too long, you will need to start paying tuition fees, but they're only €360.
Yeah.
So you can manage that if you really needed a break.
So as well as the sort of bad bits, the downsides, so, you know, if you have a health episode or your parents split up or, you know, you crash your car or whatever, that makes sense to me. But are there good reasons why students might pause or, you know, are there opportunities that students take? Does some stop to earn money or does some stop to volunteer or...?
Yeah, for example, we as student union representatives often take a less amount of classes so that we can focus on student union work to represent all of the students who need us.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't do the work we do if we needed to study full-time.
Yeah.
I think at the Graz University of Technology, I think 25 credits while being an elected representative with a lot of work to do was somewhat of a record. Yeah. And so that kind of shows the amount of commitment that being a student representative takes. We do a lot of work here in Austria. We do a lot of important things here, which means that you just can't afford to be as active a student as you maybe would like to be.
Yeah.
Which I think is fine, because student union work is extremely important and you're helping people. And so to have the license to chill out a bit with your studies and help people, I think is a very good part of the system.
Yeah. Also, for example, we have a big issue in Austria with teaching positions. So we're missing a lot of teachers. So a lot of students stop their studies to help society and help schools that need teachers to just teach the children and then finish their studies once the situation has stabilized a little bit.
Wow. And I guess, I mean, I think, you know, the other thing that's coming up a lot in the UK is, the good news is a real rise in neurodiverse students that are autistic, that have got social communication difficulties, you know, the kind of the non-physical disabilities. And what lots of them say is they just want a little longer to get into their student community, to be familiar with the environment. Presumably that really helps.
Yeah, it does. We also have special advice for neurodivergent students that says exactly that. I mean, we wish it would be better in Austria as well, so that neurodivergent students didn't have to pay tuition fees as soon as they would need to. But we do agree that they need the break, they need more time, they need more help.
Yeah.
And we do want everyone who wants to study and who is able to study to be able to finish their studies. I think that's the thing we can all agree upon.
Yeah.
And if you make it only 3 years and then after that you're done, then you take the opportunity for a lot of people. And then you're also probably shooting yourself in the foot by taking people away from the workforce that probably would be extremely competent and be amazing at the jobs they would be able to do if they got their degrees. But, you know, they had an episode, or they are neurodivergent, or they have some sort of reason why they needed more than 3 years.
But on that, so in the UK, post-Brexit, we've got a real problem with participation in the labour market. So our Treasury is desperate for people to leave university so they can be working full-time in, you know, cafes and bars and all the shortages. But presumably, even in Austria, there's a concern that some students are taking too long, and they are trying to speed you up a little bit, aren't they?
Yeah, of course, because some studies need about 6 or 7 years to finish, bachelor studies.
Right.
But the issue often aren't the students. The issues are professors or the infrastructure at university that makes it difficult to finish. Because some professors sometimes say that they find quality by 90% of the students failing. And we need to address these issues and find ways for studies to become manageable in the time that they should be able to that in the time they should be able to get finished.
Yeah. Most studies have a few well-known problem professors.
Or problem exams.
Yeah, problem exams, or where people have an astonishingly hard time. And there's one or two of those in most degrees that I know of. And so that makes finishing on time really hard. On the labour market thing, it's probably also, Austria probably doesn't worry as much because, again, most students do work anyway. So they're in the labour market already.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe just not 40 hours, but they're in the labour market already.
Yeah.
Like most of those student cafes, restaurants and etc. are run by students who work part-time next to study.
Yeah.
I think they would all have to shut down if the students needed to study more.
Yeah. So here's some fresh thinking. We'll slow down a bit. You speed up just a little bit. Meet in the middle. All done.
My name is Maya Ruga.
My name is Daniel Wagner.
Brilliant.
Now, the Spectator's theatre critic hasn't been covering himself in glory this week. Julian, what's happening?
There's an extremely grubby article about female academic, which has created quite a firestorm of complaints and issues. And there's been stories in papers about the way in which female academics and or retired academics have faced sexism in their careers, whether it's making tea, being asked to make tea, or the sort of behaviour they get from audiences and lectures. And so it's a big societal problem. And Office of Students said yesterday they're planning to put out their sexual harassment guidance following the consultation in May. And part of us in kind of think, oh, another and more bureaucracy, more regulation. But when you see some of the stuff that's out this week, you think, God, it can't come soon enough.
Yes, right. I mean, Sally, the article, people can read up on it and in their own space. I thought it was a parody when I first read it, sort of beggar's belief. But it does raise, it has, and kind of rightly raised a bunch of issues, hasn't it, about sexual harassment and about women academics.
Yeah, I read this and I was just really tired by it. Can I also just say, please don't, to everybody listening to this, please don't read the article. Like, it's definitely not worth your time. But the main premise is an extremely grubby man went to a lecture of an esteemed academic and took away from it that he really lusted after her and fancied her, not that she had anything useful to say and didn't have a huge amount of sort of incredible insight in her sort of area of expertise. I think I just feel really tired by it. Almost every woman I know has experienced this in academia. I think that it's probably also worth contextualising this and saying I think that this is a huge problem in HE that we need to grapple with. It is also a wider problem. I was talking to a colleague about this ahead of the podcast yesterday, and she made the point that you could sort of replace HE with lots of other sectors, and it would also, no one would bat an eyelid. This would ring true in lots of sectors. So I think this is a sadness to me that higher education, in many ways really progressive, is so not in this space. And actually we see all these stories that just feel like that we are, you know, going back in time. We also, I think, talk quite a lot, rightly, about protecting undergraduate students from staff. And a lot of the kind of ongoing work of the Office of Students has focused on that. And that's really, really important. It's absolutely not to decry or undermine that work. But I think this just, you know, this is an esteemed academic. She's a professor. She's established in her field. And it just sort of underlines the misogyny faced by women across HE in all levels. And that's just really sad, I think.
Yeah, so the Times then sort of followed this up with a few sort of different perspectives from female academics or, you know, people who had left academia, you know, and I think it's sort of, obviously the original thing is just really gross and I can't believe the Spectator thought that was sort of fit to publish. But, you know, some of the other things also just, you know, around, for example, one of the academics was saying about the sort of sexist negative comments she would get from students in module feedback. You know, it just feels like that's an ongoing issue that's very well understood, very well, you know, evidenced by research that, you know, female academics are evaluated worse and also, you know, receive, you know, more negative feedback because of their gender. And yet nothing's, you know, it's not really getting reckoned with. If it was the other way around and there was research evidence showing that, you know, female students were being marked more harshly by academics, then, you know, ministers would be being asked about it. It would be in the press much more often. You know, I think, as you said, Sally, we all know female academics who, you know, are working in just really depressing macho cultures, you know, where these sort of just entrenched attitudes that we can sometimes forget. It sort of seems like things from 50 years ago, but people are still dealing with it. And it's the kind of thing that really ruins your working experience and drives you out of academia.
It's worth just understanding what will happen next, because OFS will introduce some expectations, but OFS regulates students. Is in the interest of students. It doesn't directly regulate the university staff relationship. So where some of those stories are about, you know, harassment internally between, you know, different members of staff, that is going to end up with how the university themselves deal with it. In my sector, in colleges, there are, you know, it's sort of staff codes of conduct, and we also have the kind of Ofsted safeguarding regime up to the age of 19, which kind of conditions behaviour across the piece. But I think it is something also for employers and institutions to think about how it is that they do prevent bad conduct up front, and then how do they act when they get reports.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing that this always surfaces is how disproportionately the structure of universities, the gender structure of universities is. So often you find that the most senior people in all these institutions are male, and, you know, female academics who are going to make these complaints and raise these issues don't always feel comfortable or able to do that. And so we need to think more about kind of our wider environment. I am not suggesting for a moment that every man in a university would write or think the things that this grubby theatre critic has said. But I do think that people should be aware of kind of how all these things play out, where you have vulnerable women who are receiving this sort of, you know, they're subject to this sort of abuse, that then reporting that. And sort of seeing themselves in the stretches of the university is much more difficult.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today and find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Sally, Julian and Michael, who also make the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.